Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Sochi Talks returns. Today, you'll hear from Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt on creating change agents through the liberal arts. WISO Development Director Luke Dennis will join us in studio to talk about a special event coming your way, an evening with David Isay, founder of StoryCorps. And for Father's Day, we'll hear from Miami Valley StoryCorps participants Dan Carl and Mike Castle. They'll tell us about the birth of their son, Gideon. Later in the program, reinvention stories. Up first, the weekend news. Republican Congressman Mike Turner has introduced a bill that would prohibit the IRS from misusing funds. The legislation comes after it was discovered that the IRS spent $50 million on over 200 conferences during the past 2 years. At a hearing last week, Turner says he uncovered the practice of misusing funds when IRS officials were questioned about an expensive conference that recently made headlines when videos surfaced of IRS employees line dancing and engaging in video parodies. An Internal Revenue Service official involved in that 2010 conference defended the action, saying no rules were broken and no fraud occurred, but acknowledged that the lavish spending never should have happened. Turner says the Stop IRS Act will end government slush funds and reduce the federal deficit. The bill would prohibit the IRS from transferring taxpayer money from other sources to their own funding. It adds that unused funds by the IRS would be given back to the Treasury Department within 90 days for the sole purpose of deficit reduction. In another scandal for the Obama administration, since it was revealed that the government has been collecting the phone and internet records of Americans, lawmakers have been debating whether or not this is a necessary tool for fighting terrorism. That is the subject of this week's Politics Ohio with WISO News Director Emily McCord.
I'm joined today by Thaddeus Hoffmeister. He's a law professor at the University of Dayton. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Emily.
Is this type of surveillance unprecedented, or is this part of something that's been happening for a long time?
Well, I think the unprecedented part is the sheer number and the volume of information the government was gathering.
Is this something that started with the Obama administration, or is this something that's been going on before that?
No, I think it's been going on extensively since 9/11. And you saw some of the it was strengthened, in the Patriot Act, you saw certain telephone companies given immunity from civil actions by individuals for turning over this information, but has been going on quite extensively since 9/11.
From a legal standpoint, is this a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
No, the government has the authority to do this. The Supreme Court has held that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this information. From my understanding, they never actually got into the content of calls or email or things people posted on social media. I think you'd have a different issue if it was content, but from my understanding, they were just monitoring the who you called, who called you, what you posted, not the actual content, but what you placed in the cloud, things like that, but not exactly the information itself.
And this whole scenario is made for some interesting political bedfellows. Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner called the man responsible for the leaked information, Edward Snowden. He's called him a traitor. And then Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein says that what he's done is an act of treason. Legally speaking, is the whistleblower Snowden, is he a traitor?
I think the term traitor can be bandied about anyone who feels that they are not supporting the government 100%. The actual interesting treason is one of the few crimes in the Constitution. So it's spelled out exactly what defines an act of treason. And it's a charge that's rarely brought because it's a challenge difficult to prove. So I think itself to be called a traitor, I mean, you could label that, you could place that label on anyone who you believed acted in any way, shape, or form in contravention to what the government wants.
But as far as treason goes?
It would be a hard sell. They could probably do other charges. I think treason would be a difficult charge. Act in aiding and comforting the enemy, I think that would be difficult to prove. I think there's other charges you could bring, that he violated with respect to turning over these documents, but treason would be a tough sell.
What's the big takeaway from all this, legally speaking, the implications of what this could mean for citizens' privacy down the road?
They set a standard in CATS. That's the Fourth Amendment test, whether or not your Fourth Amendment rights have been violated by the government. You got to have a subjective belief, an expectation of privacy, and that's got to be an expectation of privacy that society wants to uphold. And the Supreme Court or even Congress may want to relook at the things that we expect to be private. You know, some people will be surprised at the fact that your phone records aren't private. You know, who you call, that's not private. You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. That may surprise some people. And some people may say, you know, I think we should relook that. I think there should be laws in place to protect my privacy, especially now in the digital age when it's quite nearly impossible to get off the grid. You know, you just can't have that, you know, knee-jerk reaction. You have to balance in it. I think the government is trying to show that the reason they need these things is because it helps thwart terrorism and crime. So people have to, you know, reflect and think, you know, you have to balance your privacy with security. And as we get further away from 9/11, I think people may go closer to safeguarding their privacy as opposed to their security. But as with the Boston Marathon bombing demonstrated, there's still an issue. There's still concern. There's still risk. I'm glad the conversation is going. I'm glad people are talking about this. But I want to hope people see the entire picture and realize, you know, there's a yin and yang here, you know, with security and with privacy.
I've been speaking with Thaddeus Hoffmeister from the University of Dayton. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me, Emily.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. In studio with me, WYSO Development Director Luke Dennis. And Luke, today we want to make sure that folks know about a great opportunity to spend time with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay.
That's right. One of the most interesting people in public radio is coming to Dayton to help WISO out. It's a fundraiser for our Community Voices program. Dave Isay is the guy who invented StoryCorps, which is this really innovative model in which people who know each other well get to spend an hour in a recording booth interviewing each other and asking each other questions. And what comes out of it are these very intimate, revealing, wonderful interviews that what Isay says he's doing is working to gather the wisdom of humanity, right? It's less oral history as the collection of the wisdom of everyday people. And that those stories tend to come out when a mother interviews a daughter or when a grandson interviews a grandfather. And that's what he's doing. And people might remember that 4 years ago, the iconic StoryCorps Airstream trailer was parked in front of the Schuster Center. And over 200 interviews were conducted within that trailer. 200 couples, pairs of people from around the Miami Valley got to record their stories. And people have been talking about it ever since. Dave Isay agreed to come back to Dayton to host this event at the Schuster Center for us. And I should say, it's not in the Schuster Center on the big stage. It's in the small black box theater called the Mateel Theater, which is close to the 2nd Street entrance. And he's just going to talk about the power of listening, the history of StoryCorps. There will be a reception beforehand with food. You'll get to meet him, and if you'd like to buy one of his books, he'll also sign your book at the end of the program.
Well, the venue certainly matches what StoryCorps is, these small, intimate moments between two people, these shared moments, both the people who have participated in the event, in the interviews, and for WISO listeners tuning into these stories. We've had response on stories that we've been rerunning this past week.
That's right. There's actually a piece in the Yellow Springs News in which one of the interviewees was interviewed again by the YS News. Her name is Jane Scott. And you, our listeners will remember this interview. She interviewed her mother. It's a wonderful segment. It does create a special experience for the people interviewing each other as well as for the listeners out there in the radio world.
And you can be a part of that experience on Friday, June 21st at the Schuster Center. Let's give folks some more details on where they can find out information about ticket price and what else they're going to get for their ticket.
If you want to purchase a ticket, you can go to ticketcenterstage.com. If you want to read more about the show, there's also a post on the WYSO website about it at the very top, wyso.org. There's a reception that starts at 7:30 in the Schuster Center lobby on June 21st. We will feed you. Isay will be there. You'll get to talk to him and ask him some questions. His presentation will be at 8 o'clock, and that's on the power of listening and the history of StoryCorps. And then right afterwards at 9 o'clock or so, Books & Company will be there selling some of the StoryCorps books. And Dave Isay will do a book signing.
Great. We'll see everyone there on Friday, June 21st at the Schuster Center. You can go to our website, wyso.org, to find out all of the details. And WYSO Development Director Luke Dennis, thanks for stopping by.
It's always a pleasure.
And in honor of Father's Day, we bring you this StoryCorps. Dan Carl and Michael Castle have been together for 18 years. The Centerville couple says they are religiously married, just not legally. Castle is the pastor at Harmony Creek Church in Kettering. His partner, Dan Carl, works in the medical field. Mike and Dan came to the StoryCorps booth to share their story of the birth of their first child, Gideon.
So, Dan, did you ever think we'd be at this place in our lives?
No, to be honest with you, especially at the age of, I was 38, you were 41 at the time of Gideon's birth.
Well, we were, it talked about we'd like to be parents. We kind of dreamed about that occasionally, mentioned it. And I actually even contacted Montgomery County Children's Services, and they sent me this humongous packet of materials. It was kind of overwhelming. I thought, oh my goodness, we'll never get this paperwork filled out. And so I had it there. It was there. Hadn't done anything with it. And I happened to be visiting at the hospital. There was a woman in our church who had given birth, and I went there to pray and celebrate with her and her partner. And she asked me in the hospital, Mike, have you and Dan ever thought about being parents? And I was like, oh, yeah, we've kind of talked about it. We've thought about it. But I just thought, well, I doubt it'll ever happen. But if it ever happens, somebody will show up at our door. And they'll say, Mike and Dan, we have a kid, and we need to put him up for adoption. Would you guys take him? And we'll say, yes, and it'll change our lives forever. I kind of joked about that at the hospital. Little did I know that she would show up at your workplace a few weeks later. And what did she tell you there?
At that point in time, she told me that her sister was pregnant. And I said, well, when is she due? And she said, in 5 weeks. And I just froze. And I said, I need to call Mike. Am I ready for parenting? Was my question.
Well, when you called, I was surprised, but I was excited. And so we scheduled the meeting. We get to the attorney's office. We meet her for the first time. And of course, the attorney goes through telling us about what's involved in adopting a child. And the first thing he tells us is what you plan to do is not legal in the state of Ohio. We're like, what? So he lined out a four-step process, the first being that I would be given power of attorney, understanding that only I could do this in the state of Ohio, because right now Ohio does not permit same-gender couples adopting children together. We left there that day, and your workplace had already planned a shower where 50-some nurses fill our car with all this stuff.
We had 35 infant outfits. 35.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is going to happen.
The baby shower was on a Wednesday. The next Wednesday, you woke up and said, the baby's going to be born today or tomorrow. And I said, Mike Castle, bite your tongue. I said, mm-hmm. We have another week to get ready.
And sure enough, that night at 4:30, as I was getting ready to leave work, I called Dan and said, Dan, I just got the call. Gideon's getting ready to be born.
He greeted me on the phone saying, Daddy, and I about flipped because I thought, no, it can't happen already. I'm thinking, of course, I need to run to the hospital right away. And you, being calm and nonchalant, just decided we should have dinner first. I thought you were crazy.
So in all of our excitement, we go bumbling into the hospital, and they called us to the side, and they said, Mike and Dan, we just need to have a little chat with you. And they said, you know, birth mother had crack in her system. And so, therefore, we just want to prepare you on what could happen. And as they went all through the worst-case scenarios, and it was kind of very unsettling, very disorienting, but we felt very committed. About 30 minutes later, they came back and said, Mike and Dan, Gideon is born. It looks like he's a healthy little boy. And we breathed a sigh of relief.
And so there we are in the nursery, and right after the baby's born, they handed him to me, and you and I were there together, and Kelly Clarkson had just won American Idol, and her song was on the radio playing quietly in the nursery, and it was People Wait a Lifetime for a Moment Like This. And of course, as I'm feeding Gideon his first bottle, I say, Gideon, this is our song.
Yep. And it couldn't be any more dramatic for two gay men to have a clear Kelly Clarkson song playing in the background as we welcome this new little life into our life. It's very special.
A moment like this, some people wait a lifetime for a moment like this, some people search forever for that one special kiss. Oh, I can't believe it's happening to me. Some people wait a lifetime for a moment.
Dan Carl and Michael Castle. Gideon is now 10 years old. This Miami Valley StoryCorps was originally broadcast December 8th of 2010. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Soshi Talks is a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. It's an effort to bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena, a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, creating change agents through the liberal arts. Our speaker today is Mark Roosevelt, president of Antioch College.
At Antioch, we've had this incredible opportunity to rethink what it means to be a liberal arts school at this time in history. We closed, and we are reopening. And we didn't want to just use that to do everything the way we were doing it before. We wanted to pause and think, what do students need to be able to function effectively and have rich lives in this very fast-changing world? We believe that students should have both breadth of knowledge, meaning they should take courses across many different subject areas, the sciences, the social sciences, and the arts, but that they should also have respect for deep knowledge. So let me talk a little bit about some of the adaptations that we have made. One, we have an emphasis on language. We strongly encourage our students to reach intermediate oral proficiency in a second language. In this world, if you're going to be able to succeed, if we as a nation are going to be able to succeed, we're going to need more people who speak other languages. Just as an example, about 250 million Chinese learn English. Approximately 48,000 Americans learn Mandarin. So this gap between what Americans are doing to adapt to this changing world economy and what other folks are doing is pretty significant. So we place an emphasis on language. Secondly, we created these courses called global seminars. And we have six global seminars. They're focusing on some of the most critical problems that we all face. And that are threatening the quality of life across the world. Number one, food. We're located in the middle of America's heartland and food production area. Food is an ever-increasing issue. How is it raised? The quality of it? Are we going to be able to raise sufficient quantities to feed an ever-expanding population? Number two, water. Another huge issue that everybody is facing to one degree or another and will become more severe in the years ahead. Number three, energy. How can we produce sufficient energy to heat and cool and to do what we need to do and what others are going to need to do as nations like China and India, with five times our population, become huge energy users, what is going to happen? What are going to be the climate effects? What are going to be the new forms of energy we might be able to produce to reduce those effects? Number four, public policy and how public policy relates to these other issues that are happening. Obviously, water, food, energy, these issues have to be addressed by governments and by public entities, and they need to understand how to work with the private sector on it. Number five, healthcare. An ever-increasing part of our budgets goes to paying for healthcare. The new legislation affects this enormously. But what is our theory about the future? What is our vision that is going to be able to have adequate health care delivered to folks as the population ages and as people's health care needs expand and the cost of that health care expands? And number six, education. In this world now, and especially in America, the people who are being left out in the greatest number are the undereducated. When we had a manufacturing sector, you could be a high school dropout or with a high school degree, get a decent job with decent wages, decent health benefits to bring up a family. Those jobs mostly are gone. Certainly we know that in this area of Ohio, and they're probably not coming back. They're almost definitely not coming back. So increasingly what you can earn is a product of what you've learned. What adjustments have we made to that as a nation? 30% of Americans graduate from college. 30% of Americans graduated from college 30 years ago. We have not done anything to systemically increase the number of Americans graduating with degrees that enable them to compete in this new economy. What is the plan? So what we've done at Antioch is we've taken a core liberal arts program and we've sought to adapt it to the changing nature of the world that we face. But Antioch has never been just a traditional residential liberal arts college. And that is because probably the core Antiochian innovation that took place in the 1920s under the presidency of Arthur Morgan was cooperative education. So Antioch has always been offering its academic program with the theory that if students also get out in the world and do work during their college years, that that work experience will enhance their academic program and vice versa. In other words, if I'm in the workplace and I understand the need for the various learnings that are taking place on the college campus, that will make that much more immediate to me, and I will understand that learning better. So at Antioch, we are a year-round school. Students are in for all four seasons, and then they are out for at least four of their terms. We're on quarters in jobs. These are paid jobs. These are jobs that might or might not connect to their academic major, but they are designed to be a part of a student's entire growth experience in college. So Antioch is a liberal arts residential school where students come to take traditional liberal arts courses, augmented now by an emphasis on global seminars that address these critical issues that the world is facing, language acquisition, in which most of our students will achieve intermediate oral proficiency, which is basically conversational speaking ability in another country, in a second language, and they will go out in the world and they will work for at least four quarters of their academic life. The goal here is to make students who can go out upon graduation and be effective in the world. We are not a pre-professional school. We are not just preparing students for careers. We believe that liberal arts offers also the ability for richness in life, the ability to understand that life is not just all about work. On the other hand, we also believe that a college education has to prepare students for the world in which they're entering. So we're seeking a balance and to achieve a balance between the richness of liberal arts and also preparing our students to be able to make change in the world and be effective in the world. Many young people are given to looking at the world in very black and white terms. One of the things that a liberal arts education should do is help students see gray. It should help students see that not everything is clear cut. And in the end, one of the amazing things about a liberal arts education is it should also be what we call a humility accelerator. We want people to understand that they could always know more and understand more about what is happening. When we look out at all of the problems we're going to leave to these young people to go out into the world and help us solve, we can learn about ourselves that perhaps we haven't been respectful enough, both of what you can know and what we don't know. Antioch has always been an incredibly ambitious place. We are a place in which we hope that students come to dwell in a learning community in which our goals are actually to produce a form of study and a form of thinking about the world in which students will go out and try to make effective change. Deep within the soul of this college is Horace Mann's quote, which I sometimes think is a little sharp-elbowed, but it's very much a part of both Antioch and Yellow Springs, where we're privileged to reside, in which he exhorted the graduates of his first class in the 1850s to be ashamed to die without winning some victory for humanity. That's a high aspiration, but it's the kind of aspiration that Antioch has always had and that we embrace as we build a new Antioch in a new era. Thanks for listening, and I hope you get a chance to visit us at Antioch College. Come to Yellow Springs. It's a unique place. A unique community.
Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt in this week's Soshi Talks. This week on Reinvention Stories, we meet Jeremy Panucci, owner of the Hazy Shade Disc Golf Shop in Belmont. Panucci grew up in Riverside. He always wanted to get into construction and worked in that field for 8 years. Panucci found it less satisfying than he expected and realized the toll it would take on his body. He was looking for something new when he was introduced to the sport called disc golf.
My friends kept saying, you should come play disc golf, you know, because Belmont was the spot. No, that seems dumb. Disc golf. So we go to the park and I'm hooked. I mean, now it's 3:30 and you're staring at your watch wondering how soon you can be off work and on the course. You're on the course and the sun's coming down. You're finding your discs with your phone in the grass, going up and doing the same thing the next day. There was really no place around town to buy discs. Used to buy at Renaissance Music. And the guy there was an older guy and he wasn't friendly. You couldn't touch any of the discs. They were all behind the counter. You'd be like, wow, what does a cheetah do? And he's like, I don't know, it's a frisbee. So you'd buy because the picture on the front was cool. And I thought, you know, we could do this. There's got to be a demand for it. You're not competing with any big box stores. I remember quitting my job as a contractor. It was summer. We were slow, and I was painting. And I just thought, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life saying what if. I at least have to go out there and fall on my face so that I'm not 50 going, I should have done this. I didn't want regrets. You know, I texted my wife. I said, I'm scared. And she said, you should just do it. And so I did. I put in my 2 weeks and I left. I think everybody thought I was just crazy. I mean, all my brothers went to college and they're all engineers and computer science guys. And here's Jeremy going to go make a bad decision again and throw away his money. When we opened, I bet we had 4 or 5 shelves of discs. And there was a lot of time after that where, you know, we would do $120 in a day. I remember playing hacky sack inside the store. I might watch a whole movie and not see a customer some days. I think the recession actually helped us. The drop in the economy almost drove the growth of disc golf. Because now you're going to look at what can I take my kids out and do and not have to spend tons of money. So you could spend $25 and play a whole year and not spend any more money.
And by the time that things were starting to look like, hey, we might make it here, my landlord and I could not see eye to eye on the value of their space, so I decided I needed to move.
I had this big idea that an indoor golf store putting room was going to be huge. You know, I'd never heard of anything like that. There was nowhere where anybody could do anything like that. That was a big driving force.
So about 3/4 of both of these sides will be the putting room. The ceiling goes. We exhausted every means we thought necessary or possible on this street to stay. I mean, we were inches away from leaving Belmont. I was ready to give up. But we wanted to stay. This is where we started. I'm glad we could pull it off. We have a little following. It's pretty neat. But that's why we also have to continue to grow.
The community itself in Belmont, as far as property and business-wise, could use a boost of self-worth. It's struggling. It's struggling because not enough of the people who own and live in Belmont care enough. And everybody wants someone else to make the difference for them, and no one is willing to step up and be a difference maker. Not, I shouldn't say no one, but not enough people are willing to step up and be difference makers. It's going to take people actually caring enough about their own stuff to make a difference, because there won't be a big white horse that rides through and saves us and puts new fascia on your business and picks the grass out of the sidewalk in front of your store. So it's going to take the neighbors.
Hazy Shade Disc Golf is located on Watervliet Avenue in Belmont. The store's new location is expected to open July 4th weekend, almost across the street from the current store. This reinvention story was produced by Julia Reichert, Chandra Jones, Kyle Wilkinson, and Eric Risher. Visit reinventionstories.org to learn more about Jeremy and share your story on the interactive map. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.